Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And welcome to those who are joining us for the second half of the retreat, or just for the morning. And also welcome to those who showed up having no idea that there was a retreat in progress. We make it flexible so that people can be here for part of it. This retreat, this weekend, we've been looking closely at the teachings of Dogen, the 12th century Japanese monk who went to China, brought Soto Zen practice back to Japan, and started the first monastery there called Eiheiji. Well, he started a small monastery first, and just outside Kyoto. And then moved his monastery into the mountains north of Kyoto. And that monastery is called Eiheiji. It continues to be a primary, really the main Soto training center in Japan today, almost 800 years later. And some of us went there 3 years ago on a trip. Susan, who else? Yeah, Flo and Todd, and some others are in Lee and Lucille, and some others are going this year in May. And it's a beautiful place. When we hear Dogen's name, like you'll hear it today in our dedication of our service, where we chant our Zen ancestors, short list of Zen ancestors, you'll hear his name, Eihei Dogen. And the Eihei is referring to that monastery that he founded. Eihei means eternal peace. And Dogen, his Dharma name, means, Do is way, the way, and Gen is source. So way source, or source of the way. And sometimes you may hear him referred to as Dogen Zenji. And Zenji just means Zen teacher. Or so it's often translated as master, Zen master. So just in case you hear some of those other words come out of my mouth, besides just Dogen, mostly I'll just call him Dogen. And the text we're focusing on this weekend is called Genjo Koan. And this translation that we just passed out is one by Kaz Tanahashi. He translates it as actualizing the fundamental point, although there are a whole lot of other possible ways to translate Genjo Koan, which I talked about yesterday. Dogen wrote this text quite early in his career when he had just started to teach. It was the third piece of writing that he did. But he then revised it a year before he died, and he placed it at the very beginning of the Shobo Genzo, which is his sort of masterwork collection of writings, The Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. So Genjo Koan lies at the very core of Dogen's teaching. We talked about the meaning of the title yesterday. Genjo, and I'm reviewing a little bit for the folks that weren't here, and maybe for the ones who were. Genjo means to manifest or appear, come into being. This word, Genjo, appears 300 times in Dogen's Shobo Genzo. I didn't count, but someone else did me the favor. I think it was Shohaku Okumura, whose commentary is I would really recommend. There are a number of English commentaries in English. This is the one I would recommend most strongly. And Shohaku Okumura was Michael's and my first Soto Zen teacher in Japan. We practiced with him for several years, and it was an invaluable introduction. So Genjo, coming into being, manifesting in each moment. Koan is the same word that we use for the classical Zen koans, the teaching stories and questions. used to shift us out of our conventional dualistic thinking. The etymology of the word koan is quite complicated and interesting, but rather academic, so I'm going to skip over that. And I kind of prefer to leave the word untranslated and to call Genjo Koan, to translate Genjo Koan as the koan of manifesting our life in each moment, just as it is. The koan of how do we live our lives. In a world that's always changing, that's impermanent. So it's kind of the fundamental, I see Genjo Koan as the fundamental koan of life and death. We talked about that a little bit yesterday. Uchiyama Roshi, who is Shohaku's teacher, who was Shohaku's teacher, also a wonderful Japanese Zen teacher of the mid-20th century, translates Genjo Koan as the ordinary profundity of the present moment becoming the present moment. So it's the central question of our lives. It's about how we sit zazen and how we live. Dogen uses a lot of poetic imagery and metaphor in this work to describe the kind of dynamic functioning of Genjo Koan, the koan of our lives, of awakening to the true vastness of our lives. So what we've been doing is reading it together. And then I give some commentary. And then at the end we all break into small groups and have some discussion together. So we're going to invite everyone here to be part of that, even if you're not here for the whole retreat. So some of you have numbered copies, and some of you don't. I'm going to ask somebody to read. We're going to start with number 10, because that's where we left off. And it's the paragraph that begins, "When Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind." So, Michael, do you have one of those copies with the numbers written?
I have numbers on this one.
Yeah, could you tell the people where that is on the unnumbered?
Page 25, second paragraph from the end.
So that's your second page.
Second page.
Yeah. Second paragraph from the end.
"When Dharma does not fill."
Yeah. So, could someone read that who didn't read yesterday? Claire.
"When Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind, you think it is already sufficient. When Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand that something is missing. For example, when you sail out in a boat to the midst of an ocean where no land is in sight and view the four directions, the ocean looks circular and does not look any other way. But the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace. It is like a jewel. It only looks circular as far as you can see at that time. All things are like this. Though there are many features in the dusty world and the world beyond conditions, you see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach. In order to learn the nature of the myriad things, you must know that although they may look round or square, the other features of oceans and mountains are infinite in variety. Whole worlds are there. It is so not only around you, but also directly beneath your feet, or in a drop of water."
Thank you. I have an extra copy. So, when Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind, you think it is already sufficient. When Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand that something is missing. Dogen is saying that when our views are limited, we think we already know it all. You notice that? It's much easier to see in other people to see in ourselves. When someone else is being a know-it-all, unable to see any other perspectives, especially yours, it's harder to see our own rigidities, our own limited minds. But when we have the vast perspective of the Dharma, we do see our limitations. We see that our life is conditioned and that our view is always partial. Always contingent. Our views are always contingent, formed by our environment and so many factors, right? And impermanent. We see this when our Dharma eye is open. As Suzuki Roshi, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, our Dharma great-great-great-grandfather, as he famously said, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. Yeah. Dogen uses the analogy, right, of sailing out in a boat in the midst of the ocean, where no land is in sight. And you view the four directions, the ocean looks circular. But, in truth, the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace, like a jewel, he says. He's referring to a traditional Buddhist analogy called the four views of water. Fish see water as their home, a palace. Heavenly beings see water as a jewel. They see the beauty of the light sparkling on the water. Humans see it as water, essential to our lives. And hungry ghosts see it as fire, a torment. Water torture. That just flashed into my mind as I read that. Water is used as a torture, right? It's all relative. Water, which can be such a blessing, can also be a torture. It can also be hugely destructive or nourishing. So how we see the things of the world is, of course, relative to what kind of being we are and our particular needs. And it's not so easy to see from the perspective of other human beings, let alone other species. Right? I've never been in a boat out of sight of land. Probably some of you have. Raise your hand if you have. Yeah. It's a different perspective, I'm sure. And I've never gone scuba diving to see the jeweled palaces, the strange and beautiful creatures that live beneath the surface. Raise your hand if you've done that. Yeah. I've snorkeled a little. I've only seen them on TV. But how can we imagine those marvels that live beneath the surface just looking from above? All things are like this, Dogen says. Though there are many features in the dusty world being this one we live in, and the world beyond conditions, when he says that, that's the world from the perspective of Buddha nature. When our Dharma eye is open. But both in the dusty world and in the unconditioned world, you see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach. Right? And that changes. Sometimes we are open to seeing Buddha nature all around us, reflected in everyone, everything that we see and in ourselves. And sometimes our view is obscured by so many factors. Desire, aversion. The classical hindrances, desire, aversion, agitation, sloth and torpor, and doubt. They're all obstructions to our clear Dharma eye. Dogen says, you must know that although they may look round or square, the other features of oceans and mountains are infinite in variety. Whole worlds are there. It is not so only around you, but also directly beneath your feet or in a drop of water. So speaking of a drop of water, I don't know how many have ever looked through a microscope. I haven't. I've always wanted to. At the beings in a drop of water. So I'm going to introduce you to one. This is a tardigrade. These are tardigrades. Tardigrade means slow walker because they kind of waddle. They have 8 legs and they kind of waddle. They're also known as water bears or moss piglets because of their color, and they like to live in moss. They come in Easter egg colors. Now, tardigrades are only 0.5 millimeter to 1 millimeter in size. So this is a greatly magnified tardigrade. They're so small that we don't usually pay attention to them or even know they exist. But I really like knowing tardigrades exist. It keeps me humble, because they can do things we can't. They live in soil and water, and they eat pretty much anything smaller than themselves, including protozoa, algae, fungi, nematodes, and smaller tardigrades. This is what a tardigrade would look like if you were the size of a protozoa. That's the B-movie version of a tardigrade. This one is magnification of 270 times, the one I first showed you. Tardigrades have stunningly beautiful eggs. This doesn't really do them justice. Now, this is a bonus. I asked Michael to make one copy of this, and he hit the copy, and the previous numbers were on there. So I have a whole lot of copies of these. I'll leave these out, and you are welcome to take one with you, and you can color in the tardigrades and their eggs. Zen coloring is quite the thing lately. Coloring books are hot sellers on Amazon. So this is your tardigrade coloring page to take home. Tardigrades have rather exacting requirements for food, humidity, ventilation, and temperature. And if those requirements are met, there can be as many as 400,000 tardigrades in a square meter of soil. But if those conditions are unfavorable, tardigrades have the amazing ability to slowly lose all but about 3% of their water and shrivel up into an unrecognizable speck, yet remain alive and able to reconstitute themselves, even after remaining on a dried specimen of moss in a museum for 120 years. How about that? Can you do that? The reason that they can do this is that when they first hatch, baby tardigrades have exactly the same number of cells that they will have as adults. So in order to grow up, all they have to do is swell up. Amazing. They have been called polyextremophiles because they live in some of the most extreme environments on Earth and in the sea. In 2007, in an experiment called Tardigrades in Space, they spent 10 days in orbit without protection and survived exposure to temperatures from -272 centigrade to 151 plus 151 centigrade, and a dose of cosmic rays 1,000 times what it would take to kill us. So, I just want to say, this is not a digression. Would someone please read number 11 in Dogen? Anybody? Travis? Yeah.
A fish swims in the ocean, and no matter how far it swims, there is no end to the water. A bird flies in the sky, and no matter how far it flies, there is no end to the air. However, the fish and the bird have never left their elements. When their activity is large, their field is large. When their need is small, their field is small. Thus, each of them totally covers its full range, and each of them totally experiences its realm. If the bird leaves the air, it will die at once. If the fish leaves the water, it will die at once. Know that water is life and air is life. The bird is life and the fish is life. Life must be the bird and life must be the fish. It is possible to illustrate this with more analogies. Practice, enlightenment, and people are like this.
Thank you. Well, the atmosphere and the ocean do not seem quite so limitless today as they did to Dogen in the 13th century. But I think you can see his point. Each creature inhabits its element, including ourselves. Each creature has its range. The great blue whale travels tens of thousands of miles in patterns of migration that are still not well understood. What knowledge would be lost if great blue whales disappeared from the oceans? I don't think tardigrades travel far unless someone sends them out into space. But even tardigrades can't survive indefinitely without favorable conditions. And we humans can't last long at all outside our atmosphere or beneath the sea without considerable technical support. If you've seen the recent film, The Martian, with Matt Damon stranded on Mars, has anyone seen that? We watched it on Shaw on Demand. If you see it, you might be tempted to think that there's no end to what good old-fashioned American ingenuity can accomplish. But our soft human bodies remain incredibly vulnerable and can be snuffed out in a split second. Water is life and air is life. The bird is life and the fish is life, Dogen says. But what does he mean by practice, enlightenment, and people are like this? Let's read on a little bit. If somebody could read number 12. Lee?
Now, if a bird or a fish tries to reach the end of its element before moving in it, this bird or this fish will not find its way or its place. When you find your place where you are, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. When you find your way at this moment, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. For the place, the way, is neither large nor small, neither yours nor others. The place, the way, has not carried over from the past, and it is not merely arising now.
Thank you.
There's more.
Oh, there's one more sentence.
One second, I'm flipping.
Yeah, oh, I see it, Sana.
Accordingly, in the practice enlightenment of the Buddha way, meeting one thing is mastering it. Doing one practice is practicing completely.
Great, thank you. So, I'm going to refer to Shohaku Okamura's translation for the first part of this passage because I find it a little clearer, a little more helpful. He says, If there are fish that would swim or birds that would fly, only after investigating the entire ocean or sky, they would find neither place, path nor place. I think he's talking about the way that sometimes we hold back from full engagement with life, feeling that we have to know more or understand more or be wiser, more compassionate, perfect bodhisattvas. So we hold back from fully giving ourselves to our lives. And we miss the person right in front of us. We're not present for our life right here and now. So we don't find our path or our place. He's saying if the fish or birds would fly only after investigating the whole ocean or sky, they wouldn't find their place. And that's what we do, or how we hold ourselves back. When we make this very place our own, right here, our practice becomes Genjo Koan, the actualization of reality. When we make this path, right at this point in time, our activity naturally becomes Genjo Koan, actualized reality. Yesterday he used those metaphors of time and space. So again, I think here, this very place, right here in space, this very path, this point in time, is where we actualize our practice. And that actualization of our practice is actualizing enlightenment. Dogen is very firm on this, that practice and enlightenment are not separate things. That enlightenment isn't way out there, it's right here in any moment of fully awaking to our lives. So here, towards the end of his piece, Dogen is actually using the expression Genjo Koan for the first time. Seeing when we truly take our place in this moment, we actualize Genjo Koan. He goes on to say that this place, this path, is neither large nor small, does not belong to self or other, did not exist before this moment, nor has it come into being in this moment. So these are kind of the paradoxical expressions of the relative and the absolute, the oneness and distinction that we talked about yesterday. So the people who weren't here yesterday might find that a little obscure, but Dogen sets up from the beginning that our lives exist in two realities, the reality of boundless interconnection and the reality of particularity. And that our practice is to leap clear of that duality. And live in both truths at once. In practice enlightenment, he makes a word of that, practice enlightenment. There are two. He takes two characters and puts them together. He makes one word. In the practice enlightenment of the Buddha way, meeting one thing is mastering it. Doing one practice is practicing completely. Dogen tells us when we sit, to just sit. When we chant, just chant. When we bow, just bow. When we chop carrots, just chop carrots. When we practice one thing completely, we actualize awakening through our practice. Now, someone once asked Suzuki Roshi, well, what about reading while eating breakfast? And he answered, when you read and eat breakfast, just read and eat breakfast. I found that very comforting. But seriously, when I first encountered this approach to practice over 30 years ago with Shohaku Okumura and his fellow priest Tom Wright, who led a lay practice sangha in Kyoto, I was so moved by the experience of just sitting, attending to body and mind with vivid awareness, and that was enough. That I didn't have to turn myself into a perfect person or fix my life. That just my life, just as it was, so clearly interpenetrated the whole world around me. And in that awareness, we can express with dignity the particularity of our one wild and precious life, to use the poet Mary Oliver's phrase. Here is the place, here the way unfolds, Dogen says. Right here, where you are in this moment, is your place, your ho'i, that's a Zen term, means Dharma position. So in any moment, we each have a Dharma position, an intersection of space and time, a jewel on Indra's net. That's your position in that moment. So does a great blue whale or a tardigrade have a Dharma position. And from that position, which is of course always shifting, it's a dynamic position, the way unfolds to the next moment. In the next moment. Could someone read number 13, please? Susan, thanks.
Here's the place. Here the way unfolds. The boundary of realization is not distinct, for the realization comes forth simultaneously with the mastery of Buddha Dharma. Do not suppose that what you realize becomes your knowledge and is grasped by your consciousness. Although actualized immediately, the inconceivable may not be distinctly apparent. Its appearance is beyond your knowledge.
Thank you. Now, looking at the different translations of this passage, it seems to have been a tough one for the translators. Each one seems to struggle to put words in English to Dogen's reminder that because in practice enlightenment we are not separate from our own experience, it's beyond our conventional ways of knowing and being aware of what we know. He says, don't suppose that what you realize becomes your knowledge, or even that it's grasped by your consciousness. I think this is why so many koans in Zen literature rely on unconventional uses of language, or simply gesture, rather than words, to express this. And this afternoon, we're going to look at the koan that Dogen uses to close this text, along with a couple of other koans. But that's for this afternoon. It's a tempt you to stay if you want to. But now I think I'll just read you Mary Oliver's poem. I'm sure a number of you are familiar with it. It's called The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last, and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So I don't know if Mary Oliver ever read Dogen, but I think she would understand him very well. So thank you. Thank you for reading Dogen with me. And now we're going to do what we did yesterday, which is divide up into some small groups. Yeah. And what I'm going to ask you to do is just look back over the sections that we just read. For those of you who don't have, there's some pens up here. And just kind of mark in some way anything that resonated for you. Don't feel that you had to get Dogen, you know, or understand him in one reading. You can come back year after year after year to Dogen's writing and it seeps in. It seeps in gradually. So just mark anything that resonated for you. And then, and you can pass out the
paper
maybe. Then what I'd like to encourage you to do is to think of an example from your life, or two, of times when your view, your Dharma eye has been obstructed, and your view has been narrow, or rigid. And maybe then how it opened. Okay, so what I'd like you to do is think of an example or two of times that your Dharma eye has been clouded, obstructed, your view has been narrow or rigid, maybe some way that you had a preconceived notion of who this person was, and then how did it open? How did it shift? How did your view expand? What shifted, how, you know, or shift out from that closed or stuck place? And not necessarily from talking yourself out of that rigid position, but through letting go, dropping off the barricades or the armor that we talked about yesterday. Yesterday we used the word, Dogen uses the word dropping off, body and mind. Which we do when we sit. And the word he uses is datsuraku, and we talked about how datsu means like to shed, like a snake sheds its skin. And naku is to drop, like flower petals drop. So together it becomes dropping off that kind of rigid, protective exoskeleton that we construct with our ideas and our identities. So how... think of specific examples of ways that you've been closed and then opened in your view. It's a little bit like a question we did yesterday. But okay, so you can make a few notes for yourself. Just take some reflection time on your own first, looking back at the text and then thinking about your own experience, and then we'll get into small groups.